Hello and welcome back to Coffee with Conservationists, the podcast where I sit down with people who dedicate their lives to researching, protecting and documenting nature. I talk to them about issues affecting wildlife, the climate and global biodiversity. We cover diverse topics within ecology, biology, storytelling, activism and much more. My coffee feature today is from Foundation Coffee Roasters. Much like today's guest, Foundation are ocean-loving advocates. As usual, I'll be talking more about them at the end of the episode. In today's episode, I speak to Rebecca Daniel. Rebecca is an award-winning science communicator, director of the Marine Diaries, and a strong advocate of ocean conservation and storytelling. This episode was actually recorded a really long time ago, in November, I think. So, such is the way of life with the podcast, sometimes it just gets in the way and I'm not able to get episodes out as quickly as I'd like to, and I've actually recorded quite a long queue of episodes since then as well. So this episode has been a really long time coming, and I'm really glad it's out in the world, and I really hope you all enjoy it. Hey Rebecca, thank you for coming on the podcast. So I typically start these things with kind of a get to know you. How you got into wildlife, how you got into conservation, where your interest in nature first started. So yeah, that's how we'll start.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the podcast, and equally spending your Saturday morning speaking to me. I really appreciate it, and yeah, it's great to kind of meet you as well. In terms of me getting into like wildlife, ocean conservation, there wasn't really any like one aha moment. I feel like I've always kind of felt very connected to nature and animals, and always just been quite, I guess, like inquisitive and interested about the natural world. But I do think both of my parents like had a really big impact and influence. So my mum was a keen like technical scuba diver. And my dad's from Yorkshire, and he just has always loved the outdoors and going on hikes and things like that. So a lot of our holidays were very active, very outdoorsy. We always classically watched David Attenborough, Blue Planet, went to zoos and natural history museums and aquariums and things like that. When I was really young, I think I must have been about four or something, I was absolutely obsessed with dolphins. I had an entirely dolphin themed bedroom at my dad's house. So I think it's always kind of been there. And then I learned to scuba dive really young. I think it was about 9 or 10. And very quickly realized that, you know, I wanted to be a marine biologist. I think at that time I didn't really know what it meant, but I just wanted to like have a career around the ocean. Just really always enjoyed kind of studying science at school. So that kind of basically led me to do biological sciences as an undergrad, and then a master's in tropical marine biology. And I think that's really where the kind of ocean interest kind of really, really kicked off. Originally, I was kind of working in environmental consultancy in terms of career. But basically through running the Marine Diaries, I kind of realized that my real passion and skills kind of lay in the communication side of things. And I've basically been working in that sector ever since. But it's nice to also get in the ocean, I think, sometimes. So more recently, I've been trying to do more of that. And I was really lucky to be selected as the first Sheba Hope advocate. So I actually got to do some coral reef restoration in the Maldives, which was amazing. I think, And I'm sure you probably know, like sitting behind a desk is sometimes not as exciting as actually getting into the ocean and seeing the things that you're like, you know, communicating about.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know that very well. I spent my entire first year of my undergrad online. And luckily we got outside a lot, and I was living on a beautiful campus that we were allowed to, you know, spend as much time outside as we wanted, despite any restrictions in place at the time. But yeah, it wasn't fun doing an entirely nature focused degree behind a screen. It was very ironic.
How did the idea behind the Marine Diaries come about? What was the kind of sparking moment to try and bring it to life?
So that kind of started when I was doing my master's in tropical marine biology. So this was back in 2017. I'm giving everyone hints as to how old I am now. And there was kind of three of us on our course that came together and started it. And really the idea kind of came from realizing that, we were in the kind of scientific academia community, and just seeing the kind of disconnect between that community and the general public. And it was kind of around the same time that Blue Planet 2 came out, and then there was this kind of Blue Planet 2 effect on the plastic movement. It really kind of hit the public eye, and it was really just quite simple and quite clear, and there was only one issue that was discussed, and that was plastic, and that really, really was effective. And you obviously probably know this, but obviously the scientific community have known about plastic in the ocean being a problem for decades, but no one in the general public really knew about it. And until, there were obviously loads of other movements as well, but Blue Planet 2 really had this massive impact. So we noticed all of this happening, and we also, knew from obviously our degrees that a lot of the research that is so incredible and amazing that all of these scientists are doing is like kind of locked away in either paywalled journals or, no one really in the general public reads scientific papers because one, they're quite confusing. Two, you might have to pay for them, or they're looking at the news, they're looking at websites, they're not kind of going to a scientific journal to find their information. And I think as well, quite rightly, a lot of academics are focused on actually doing the research, not communicating it. And that's kind of changing now, but a lot of academics don't have either the skill set or the desire to actually do, the work to get their research out into the public eye. And that's like no fault of their own, but it's so important that the general public actually knows about these things, because if you don't know about an issue or what's happening, then if you don't even have an awareness, then how are you even meant to like take action or speak to someone or demand more from the government? There's like the education has to come first. So we kind of like realized all these things, and then we were kind of millennials. Millennial Gen Z, I don't know, it's on the borderline. But we, really kind of recognize the growing importance of social media and digital media in particular, for one, for accessing information and news, but also like this entertainment value, kind of actually seeing things that you might never see in real life. So, amazing footage of humpback whales and, turtles and places that, a lot of people might not actually get to go to. You can access all of that through social media. So originally we just launched an Instagram page and a blog. And then, it kind of grew from there, and we're now like a project-based organization. We've grown our community to, I think, over like 50,000 kind of people. And our whole focus really, which has been refined over the years, the last 5 years, is really on kind of telling really engaging, but also positive kind of solution-led stories about not just ocean life, but the people that are, trying to protect it, the people that are influenced by it, and really just connect people with the ocean and hopefully like inspire them to either find out more or like take action in whatever way makes sense for them. So that's kind of the whole premise of what we do. And we try and weave that storytelling element into, all of our projects and all of our kind of content as well.
Yeah, in regards to storytelling, how have you found that to be, how effective has have you found that to be an educational tool compared to some of the other kind of, I don't know how to phrase this. I'm going to start that again. I'm very tired, as you can
No, it's
probably
okay.
tell. In compared to some of your more academic background and your the education you were given at an undergraduate and postgrad level, how does your kind of storytelling techniques with Marine Diaries differ from that and improve upon that, kind of making it more, as you said, more accessible for everyone?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, I think there are really good ways of communicating science that are kind of used in academia. So, you know, you've got the classic like poster, you've got a lecture, got a scientific article, and then you've got scientific papers. I'm sure there's probably some more, but you know, they're typically the way that you communicate science within the scientific community is very it's very concise. It's very much introduction, context, results, discussion, and that's not really how people want their information. I think, you know, going into this ever more digital age, people want to know the results and the context and the discussion first and foremost, and they don't really care about the methods or, you know, whatever you did to get there. Some people might be interested and they can read that afterwards, but you have to kind of look at it in this, it's basically what the news does. There's these two triangles and they're completely opposite in scientific kind of comms and more kind of like news comms. They're like fully inverted. And there's kind of that element, but the storytelling element, I think, you know, in academia, you're really just focusing on the information, you know, stats, figures, maybe some kind of context and you know, referencing other papers, and this is what's been done before, and this is how it might kind of affect things. But using stories that either link to, you know, a person or an organism or even just an initiative with some kind of like history behind it, it really helps people connect more to the actual information. And, you know, human beings are kind of, we're hardwired to tell stories. It's how we've communicated for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. I don't know the correct length of time, but, you know, we really resonate with stories. If you think about when you go and tell your friends something, you're always kind of telling a story. You're not just giving them a lecture. You're not, you know, just giving them, oh, at 10 p.m. I did this and this happened and then this happened. It's like, you know, I was really excited and then this happened and then, you know, this is how I felt. Or it's about creating like an emotional connection, and then through that story people remember the information better. There's actually loads of research behind it, and, you know, it's just so much more engaging to listen to a story. And it's easier to understand because you tend to kind of give, even like, for example, like metaphors and things like that. All of the stories that we were kind of told as children that have these like hidden meanings, it's kind of like trying to use that technique to get across to people. And, you know, people, advertisers, marketers have been kind of clocking on onto how effective storytelling can be to reach customers. But now, like, more and more people and organizations are kind of realizing the power that storytelling can have to get people to care about the ocean and to learn about the science and, you know, the whole of our planet as well.
Yeah, that was a really amazingly answered question. Thank you. And how does the, leading on from that directly, how does the Marine Diaries, obviously you use storytelling in a variety of different ways. What are some of the biggest threats facing marine ecosystems today that people might not know about and that you're communicating?
Well, that people might not know about is probably rules out quite a few of them. I would say I'll answer them, that question, with two parts. That the biggest one, in my opinion, is climate change. And, you know, I still don't really think that a lot of people realize that the ocean is essentially like our biggest ally in fighting climate change. You know, I've been to COP, I've been in discussions around climate change, and it's almost surprising how much people kind of disregard the ocean when they're talking about climate change mitigation, but it absorbs 25% of the CO2 emissions that we produce and 90% of the excess heat that we've caused. And some of the most, the fastest and the most effective ecosystems that absorb carbon are blue carbon, you know, ocean-based. So to me, it's kind of wild that it's not more, that's, you know, not being talked about more. I think it is coming that way, but I think climate change, oh, sorry. Did you hear that notification?
No.
Oh,
all good.
Great. Cut this out. But yeah, I think, you know, climate change is so global, and, you know, it's leading to all of these other problems that are then kind of not necessarily kind of completely destructive on their own, but when all of these things are combined, like, that's when the real problems start. Definitely climate change, you know, ocean warming, acidification, that's causing deoxygenation, sea level rise. It's kind of impacting all of these super sensitive organisms like corals, but it's also actually creating this whole shift in the ocean of, you know, species moving towards the poles to get away from really, really warm areas. But then that creates invasive species, and, you know, the species that are at the poles, they have nowhere to go. So definitely for me, that is a really big one. But I think some of the things that people don't necessarily know that much about that we try and highlight is things like habitat destruction and degradation. And this is really leading to like a massive loss of biodiversity in the ocean. So for example, mangroves get cut down to create shellfish farms, particularly in Asia. And that's, you know, basically farmed prawns that you'll find in a lot of supermarkets in the UK and, you know, other kind of westernized areas. And there, I could go on into the problems with them, but if you Google it and you start to look into this, like, you'll realize that it's like a very short-sighted way of looking to produce you know, this food. Mm-hmm. Another thing that's kind of quite common but is being tackled a bit more now is, for example, resorts removing seagrass so that they have like these nice white pristine beaches, because they think that that's what tourists prefer. But there's, again, that education gap where, you know, the tourists are coming to see marine life, but if you remove the seagrass, then you're going to remove, you know, the chance of seeing like a turtle or a seahorse or, you know, loads of fish. So yeah, there's loads of things that we kind of try and shed a light on, I guess. But there's so many issues. And we're trying really to, I guess, educate people about them, but in a way that's got like a positive spin. So that either people can do something about it, or, you know, we try and highlight organizations or people that are like trying to tackle the issue, so it's less just kind of doom and gloom, because there are a lot of issues and it can be quite depressing, but really trying to, yeah, give people bite-sized information that's not too overwhelming.
Yeah, that's again a really great answer, because I didn't know about the issue with resorts removing seagrass, and I like to think, as a non-academic, I read a lot of academic literature. So, that's one of the issues that has escaped me.
It was particularly in the Maldives, and there was a whole campaign around it that was, I think, started. This might be wrong, so I'm sorry if it is, but by the Maldives Underwater Initiative, and they created a whole campaign called Save Maldives Seagrass. And they've now kind of basically worked with loads of resorts who are essentially planting that seagrass again, and they've all kind of pledged to no longer remove it. But yeah, just kind of, there are so many of these kind of little, well, not so little, but, you know, things that not everyone knows, and not even everyone in the ocean or environmental community knows about them either. Yeah.
Coffee's definitely helping. I think that you've hit the nail on the head there with a lot of people, even in the scientific community, don't know about these things, and there's a lot still that is under researched. I like to ask this question to everyone who works in the scientific community, and in, especially in marine science. I've had actually a few different people talking about ocean literacy and blue carbon before, but everyone's got that really unique perspective, which is why I keep inviting people back on to talk about quite similar subjects every season or so. My final question is, how can people help from home? So you talk about a lot of issues. There's a lot of issues that people don't know about, a lot that they do, a lot that is in mainstream media, and a lot that is under-researched. How can anyone, regardless of their standing in any form of scientific or non-scientific community, help out with the issues that the Marine Diaries tries to tackle?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm a kind of strong believer in that we can all do something, regardless of who we are or, you know, what's accessible to us. You know, there's 7.8 billion people on the planet, and together we can achieve a lot. But that's also to kind of, on the other hand, I don't think it's all up to just consumers and just individuals. But if we think about ourselves as individuals within businesses, organizations, governments, it kind of comes back to that individual level. And, you know, you can have an influence on your own personal behavior, or you can influence the business that you work for, the organization you work for, or you can really push for, you know, policy change if you have links to government or you work in government. So it kind of always does come back to us as individuals. And even as consumers, you know, what we choose to buy sends signals to businesses about what we care about. And I think that's been happening a lot in recent years. You know, people have started asking for more sustainable products, for less packaging, and businesses care because they want your money. So, you know, what you buy and what you don't buy really has an impact. But in terms of kind of making a real difference personally towards some of these issues, I think a couple of things. One thing that I would definitely recommend is actually like reconnecting with nature, or maybe connecting at all, because some people don't really have that kind of connection. So spending more time outdoors, whether that's just like, you know, going for a walk in a park, or going for a bike ride, or, you know, taking the train and going to the coast and just, you know, looking at the sea. I think the more we kind of connect with nature, the more that we'll appreciate it, and then, you know, understand why we need to protect it. And, you know, I live in London, I live in a city, I do feel very disconnected to nature on a daily basis. But there are little things that you can do to kind of, you know, kind of grab that back a little bit. And I think a few other things in terms of kind of personal choices. One of the most impactful ways as an individual to kind of reduce your carbon footprint is to switch to a more plant-based diet. And that doesn't mean you have to completely cut out meat, fish, dairy, but, you know, kind of having maybe a few days or a few meals where you have, you know, less, or completely cut it out, or trying like Veganuary or fish-free February, it's a tongue twister. You know, they're kind of like fun challenges to have a go. And I think a lot of people realize that, especially in Western society where we have so many options available, that it's not actually that difficult to do and to implement. And in terms of other kind of direct action, I honestly think volunteering or even switching your career. So thinking about like what skills you have as an individual, how can you use those skills to help, you know, an NGO or a business that's doing good? And, you know, whether that is by kind of volunteering your time or donating money or actually, you know, thinking, you know, I work in, you know, I'm an accountant. Could I be an accountant for an ocean conservation charity and really use those skills to help an organization? I think there's this kind of belief that if you haven't studied science or, you know, you don't know enough about environmental issues, then you can't make a real difference. But actually what we need is like a whole kind of shift in, you know, the business and kind of career sector of people moving towards more sustainable businesses and working for charities. So yeah, kind of that, but other things, just like speaking to people, like listening to podcasts like this, educating yourself, and then speaking to your friends and your family about, you know, the issues that you've kind of discovered and asking people questions and kind of finding out more, I think is really important.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's why I like to get everyone's different opinion on it. These, the things you've touched on, are really nuanced topics, and actually a lot I go into more depth in other episodes. So it's nice to link back and give myself a little shameless plug for people to listen to this and then go on to listen to the rest of the podcast as well. I'm actually releasing one just before this one will come out. It's scheduled to be released all about ecological learning and holistic education and how, instead of, you know, reconnecting to nature, we're relearning the belief that we are nature and nature is us and all of that kind of thing. So I think that's a really, really important first step to take. And I agree with that. And yeah, there's a lot of other nuanced topics in there that I've spent a lot of time thinking and talking about. So I'm really glad to hear you bring some of them up. We are unfortunately running out of time. So the last question that I like to ask everyone kind of levels the playing field and brings us all down to a humble level is, how do you take your coffee?
Ooh, so I am a oat flat white, you know, just person. That is my go-to. But recently I've been thinking of switching back to fully black coffee, but a really, really nice, you know, from an espresso machine type coffee. I haven't made that switch yet, so I'm still an oat flat white girl.
That's the question that divides people a lot at the end. There's a lot of people, that's the question kind of weeds out the people who actually don't drink coffee and only tell me that when they come on the podcast and answer that question. So that's really fun to then have to try and figure out something to feature on the podcast that's not quite fully coffee. An oat flat white is delicious, and that's reminded me that I might go and get one when I'm running errands in town today.
You definitely should.
Thank you very much. That's kind of everything that I wanted to cover. Before we go, where can people find you? What kind of platforms and websites do you use to promote what you do?
So I guess in terms of the Marine Diaries, it's literally themarinediaries.com. Everything that we do pretty much is on our website, so you can look at our blog, you can discover some of our projects. Our short films are on YouTube, and that again is the Marine Diaries. And yeah, we're on all social media channels as the Marine Diaries, apart from Twitter, which is the Marine Diary, although we're not really using that anymore. And then for me, you can add me on LinkedIn, or I have a personal Instagram, which is Rebecca_SaltySea. But yeah, I just want to say thank you so much for having me on the podcast, and I will definitely be listening to the episode that's coming out before mine, and all of the rest of them. Yeah, it's been really lovely to chat with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for giving up your time and for dealing with what seems to be perpetually exhausted host at the minute. Many of my guests have had to lately.
I can relate. So it's, yeah, I totally get it.
Thanks again to Rebecca for taking the time to speak to me today. As usual, you can find links to all her work and projects, including the Marine Diaries social channels, down below. My featured coffee today is from Foundation Coffee Roasters. Foundation are a local Cornish company who use direct trade sourcing and support sustainable growing practices. Like many coffee roasteries have been trying to do lately, they recycle their chaff, which is the coffee bean sort of skin byproduct from the roasting process, to mulch local allotments and growing spaces, as well as ensuring that their 330-gram coffee bags and labels are printed with low solvent inks, and they're actually completely home compostable. I haven't tested this myself yet, and I would quite like to in the future, but once used, apparently they will break down into biomass, water, and carbon dioxide. Thank you all so much for listening. I've been your host, George Steedman Jones, and this is Coffee with Conservationists.